Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobbi Jean Schweitzer, professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University and an associate editor for Anesthesiology. And you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with two authors of publications that appear in the July 2020 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Marc-Olivier Fischer. Dr. Fischer is the first author of an article titled Individualized Fluid Management Using the PLETH Variability Index, a Randomized Clinical Trial. Dr. Fischer is professor in the Anesthesiology and Critical Care Medicine Department, Normandy University, Caen University Hospital, Caen, France. Welcome, Dr. Fischer.
Hello, Dr. Schweitzer, and hello, everybody, and thank you for this invitation.
And joining Dr. Fischer is Dr. Kamal Maheshwari, who wrote in a company editorial, Goal-Directed Therapy, Why Benefit Remains Uncertain. Dr. Maheshwari is professor in the Departments of General Anesthesiology and Outcomes Research, Cleveland Clinic, Cleveland, Ohio, but he's joining us today from England. Welcome, Dr. Maheshwari.
Thanks for the invitation. A pleasure to be here.
So, Dr. Fischer, let's start with you. And would you please tell us what you were trying to accomplish with this study?
Sure. A lot of data is available regarding the benefit of goal-directed therapy to decrease the postoperative morbidity, especially for high-risk surgical patients using invasive hemodynamic monitoring. Unfortunately, hemodynamic monitoring is scarcely used at the bedside because it could be considered as time-consuming and invasive by anesthesiologists. A solution to increase its use in the operating room could be the non-invasiveness of this device. So we tested a new non-invasive and plug-and-play method, the PLETH Variability Index, as a hemodynamic monitoring to conduct goal-directed therapy in operating room to decrease the hospital length of stay following surgery.
So maybe perhaps before we get into the details of this new device in your study, I want to ask Dr. Maheshwari to help us understand this phrase, goal-directed therapy. I know it's become common in our medical vernacular, but can you define it for us? Tell us what it means exactly.
Goal-directed therapy, as the name suggests, is trying to meet an objective hemodynamic goal with the specific interventional therapy. Administration of intravenous fluid is a universal and common intervention performed by anesthesiologists and critical care physicians. And when we give fluids, how much we give, what type of fluid we give, these are important considerations to optimize hemodynamic status. And our goal usually is to maximize oxygen delivery, which we achieve by maximizing cardiac output or stroke volume with a flat portion of cardiac pressure volume curve. And so this concept has been the central tenet of the goal-directed therapy. More recently, it's been also called as individualized fluid management or individualized hemodynamic management.
So, Dr. Fischer, who did you enroll in your study, and what kinds of surgeries were these patients having?
We included adult patients scheduled for hip or knee arthroplasty under general anesthesia with mechanical ventilation.
And would you consider these patients low, intermediate, or high-risk patients, and why?
We included patients with low to intermediate surgical risk because the PLETH Variability Index was not validated for high-risk surgical patients who should benefit from cardiac output monitoring and or arterial line. In regard of the type of surgery, the surgical risk was classified as intermediate. So we can infer that the global surgical risk was intermediate.
Dr. Maheshwari, there has been quite a variability in outcomes of various trials evaluating goal-directed therapies or individualized fluid management. What's up with that?
I'm glad you asked this question. Based on an individual study, when we say a certain intervention or a drug worked or did not work, by definition, we are saying that we did not find any difference in a specific variable or outcome between the intervention group and the control group. In any individual study, the choice of outcome variable, its definition, the extent of difference between groups, which we usually call the clinically meaningful difference, are key decisions. And they also introduce the variability into different trials. There are many systematic biases like insufficient data, different population, measurement error, selection bias, confounding, and so on, which makes the interpretation of research, and especially the observational research which have been done in this area, very difficult. Randomized trials seems to be the cure for all these biases. And they are one of the best instruments, and I congratulate Dr. Fisher for doing this randomized control trial. But even with the best randomized control trial, you have different type of technology, different treatment protocol, how people adhered to the protocols during the study period. They all introduce variability. And finally, the conclusion derived from even the best RCT, which is in one population, for example, a low risk, may not be applicable to a different population, which is, let's say, higher risk or different setting, and which is the limitation of the external validity of randomized controlled trials. So there are many reasons of variability of outcomes and conclusions of various goal-directed therapy trials.
Dr. Fisher, was your study a single-center study or not? And how many patients were included in this trial?
The OBVI trial was a randomized controlled study conducted in 5 French hospitals. 447 patients were randomized in this study.
Dr. Maheshwari, what do we already know about goal-directed therapy from previous studies? I guess, can you summarize, does it work? Does it work in select populations? Are there still a lot of questions out there that we need to answer?
Yes, the work on goal-directed therapy has been ongoing for the past couple of decades. One of the first studies focused on measuring and maximizing oxygen delivery in critically ill patients. That was a landmark study. And since then, many smaller randomized controlled trials and many more observational studies have been done. But there's a huge heterogeneity in the studies with regards to their patient population, their inclusion criteria, what type of technology was used, what goals were used, and what outcomes were studied. I would focus on couple of recent trials, and because they were one of the largest and in the perioperative setting, which is relevant to the current discussion. The first one which I'm going to talk is the Optimize One trial. It was more than 700 patient trial, which studied the rate of postoperative moderate to severe complication at 30 days. And the technology which was used in this study was LIDCO, which is a type of a pulse contour analysis. In moderate to high-risk surgical patients. In this trial, in the control group, they noticed 43% complication compared to in the intervention group, they noticed 36%. So there's a 7% absolute reduction in complication, which may sound to be great that, yes, it worked, but actually it was not statistically significant because at the time of planning, the trial was powered to detect 12% absolute risk reduction. So it was inconclusive trial. The another large study which happened recently was the DORA trial, in which esophageal Doppler technology was used. Around 400 patients were included in the study. The complication rate in the control group was 16% and intervention group was 8%. Again, same exact 7% to 8% reduction in complication. But this study was said to be that, yes, we reached statistical significance because they powered at the time of planning for 19% risk reduction. So two markedly different results, but not besides many differences in outcomes which were assessed. One difference was very stark, which is that in the optimized trial, they studied complication at 30 days compared to Fedora trial, they studied complication at 180 days. So even the assessment period was different. So there's so many studies which can be discussed, but I will say that it highlights why the variability is there and why the question is not, we can say, solved yet.
Thank you for those contrasting information, which now leads me to ask Dr. Fisher about the technology that was used in his study. So I think in the treatment group, you used this plethysmographic variability index to guide fluid administration. Can you tell us what a plethysmographic variability index is and how it works?
The Plethysmic Variability Index is a non-invasive technology with a specified sensor using plethysmographic variations induced by mechanical ventilation to assess fluid responsiveness. In contrast with the pulse pressure variation, or PPV, the Plethysmic Variability Index, or PVI, is a non-invasive technology. A value of Plethysmic Variability Index is showed in a specified monitor using a floating period of 2 minutes. A cutoff value can be used to assess the fluid responsiveness of patients.
And was the plethysmographic variability index target achieved in your study? And what was that target that you aimed for?
A cutoff value of 13% has been previously described. If the value is below 13, the patient is probably non-fluid responsive. While if the Plethysmographic Variability Index value is above 13, the patient could benefit from a fluid loading to increase the cardiac output and so the tissue oxygenation. This cutoff value of 13 has been used in the present arbitrial. The length of time that Plethysmographic Variability Index or PVI was available was 86%. And the proportion of time that the Plethysmographic Variability Index was under the cutoff value of 13% during the recording time was 36%.
I want to explore more about the fluid and how that was actually managed. But before we get there, I'd like to ask Dr. Maheshwari another question. You mentioned briefly about these previous studies about the various invasive and non-invasive systems, I think, that were used and the variability across studies. So are all of these systems equally good? And if not, or if there's been one that has been highlighted as better, can you particularly contrast this system or device that Dr. Fisher used, the Plethysmographic Variability Index, and tell us how that measures up against these other methods?
It's true that many invasive and non-invasive systems right now, which are approved by FDA in the United States and carries the mark from Europe for clinical use. And yes, there are differences in limitation of these monitors in different settings. And we should closely look into a few criteria when deciding to use these monitors for clinical use. One is the accuracy, which is how well the system captures the true value, for example, stroke volume, by comparing the gold standard. Second is the precision, because we are using these monitors for repeat measurements, and we need to know the consistency with repeat measurements. Also, the effect of clinical setting, what is the effect of vasopressor use or various fluid states, various disease state. These all need to be considered. FDA approval does not mean that monitor is good in all clinical settings for all purposes. We should closely examine the limitation of each system. Having said that, there are many invasive and non-invasive systems which are currently being used, and they are helping in patient care. Specifically, PVI, which is Plethysmographic Variability Index, reflects dynamic changes in proprietary perfusion index, which is developed by the parent company. It's a non-invasive technology based on pulse oximeter. I personally have not used this thing, and I cannot comment on its performance. But I, from literature point of view, in 2016, a meta-analysis of 18 studies with 600 patients were published, showing high sensitivity, which is 80%, and specificity in predicting fluid responsiveness in operating room and ICU. So I guess it can predict fluid responsiveness. I have not come across outcome studies, which matters. And I once again congratulate Dr. Fisher, who did the, which I believe is the first outcome study using PVI technology and helped improve our understanding about the usefulness of PVI.
Thank you. So, Dr. Fisher, other than this targeted index measurement, this very, this is in the graphic variability index, did you also have other parameters, like such as a targeted mean arterial blood pressure?
Yes, we have. The mean arterial pressure target was above 65 millimeters of mercury in both treatment and control groups.
Got it. So what fluid management protocol did you use?
In the treatment group, a specific hemodynamic algorithm was designed. The first step was to achieve the place variability index below 13%. If not, a fluid loading of 3 millimeters per kilogram of gelatin was administered over 5 minutes intravenously. If the place variability index was in the target value, so above 13%, the intermittent mean arterial pressure was then observed. If its value was under 65 millimeters of mercury, ephedrine up to 30 milligrams and norepinephrine then after were used. If the mean arterial pressure was above 65 millimeters of mercury and PVI below 13, no specific treatment was conducted, but a reappraisal of both place variability index and mean arterial pressure was conducted continuously.
So if I can better understand, you used a combination of vasopressors and fluid management to try to maintain the plethysmographic variability less than 13%, and the mean arterial pressure greater than 65 millimeters of mercury. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Right. And so that was in the treatment group, I think you described. What about the control group?
The control group was managed using only intermittent mean arterial pressure value. When mean arterial pressure was below 65 millimeters of mercury, fluid loading with 3 milliliters per kilogram of gelatin and or vasopressor using ephedrine or norepinephrine with the same dose as previously described was used.
So the providers had very specific parameters of treatment. It was just the difference between the two groups was that the treatment group used this device and the control group did not. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Thank you. So, Dr. Maheshwari, does it matter what outcomes are measured when evaluating goal-directed therapy? I guess I'm trying to understand if, you know, acute kidney injury, wound infection, or other adverse outcomes depend on the same fluid management goal.
Yes. The outcomes measured are critical for making conclusion from any observational research or randomized controlled trial. As outcome researcher, I'm always anxious about which outcomes to choose. There's a couple of principles which should be applied always. One is the biological plausibility, that the intervention which we are doing will biologically make sense that it's going to affect a particular outcome or not. And the second thing is clinical importance, that if the outcome differ between control and intervention group, they are really clinically important and that we will use this intervention going forward or not. So it does matter. The incidence of viral outcome, just based on definition, can change. And as I highlighted, the differing conclusion of optimized trial and the Fedora trial, which reached to a different conclusion despite same 8% reduction in complications with the use of goldarexa therapy.
Yes. So with that background, Dr. Fisher, can you tell us what outcomes that you were trying to determine or the goals you had set to answer?
Of course. So the primary endpoint was the postoperative length of stay in days following planned hip or knee arthroplasty. This endpoint was chosen because it was considered as a good reflection of the postoperative mobility. If the plasma variability index used can improve the tissue oxygenation during surgery, this strategy could decrease the postoperative mobility and therefore the hospital length of stay. The secondary endpoints were serious postoperative cardiac and non-cardiac complications, postoperative troponin, and lactate elevation.
So, was there a difference in the amount of fluids that each group received, or how much fluid did each group on average receive?
Fluid loading was used more often in the plasma variability index group than in the control group, with a cumulative volume of fluid infused during surgery significantly larger in the plasma variability index group than in the control group, 1,088 milliliters versus 677 milliliters.
And what did you find in outcome difference or length of stay?
No difference were observed between the two groups. Regarding all primary endpoint and secondary endpoints.
So why do you think this PLEF variability index did not impact outcomes?
Individualized goal-directed therapy using PLEF variability index increases the amount of fluid loading compared with the control group, but did not provide any clinical benefits in terms of hospital length of stay or serious cardiac events, renal failure or postoperative lactate or troponin concentration. In this large and multicentric randomized control, we did not observe any benefits, clinical benefits for our study population.
You depended on the providers taking care of these patients to actually administer these medications and fluids based on the measured variabilities or vital signs in this PLEF index. Did they actually do that? Did they give fluid when they were supposed to? Did they give pressors when they were supposed to? And did they achieve those goals that we had mentioned about maintaining the PLEF index less than 13 and the MAP greater than 65?
We observe effectively difficulties to achieve the target of PVI under 13%, perhaps because the static utilization of this device is not a good solution. Indeed, as observed for the pulse pressure variation, or PPV, actually, hemodynamic test to observe the variation of this PPV during, as example, a change in tidal volume, as example, could better consider this parameter. But actually, no data are available in regard with changes in PVI during hemodynamic maneuver.
So Dr. Maheshwari, there are both, I think, semi-closed and closed-loop fluid administration platforms that actually automate fluid management protocols. And it doesn't rely on a provider to do the right thing, so to speak. Do you think these would improve compliance, and have these kinds of systems been shown to improve patient outcomes in this fluid-directed therapy trials?
Yeah, you're right. Protocol compliance is key for the successful implementation of goal-directed therapy. And the variation in protocol compliance, as noted in this current OPVI trial, is a huge issue. And I believe, yes, semi-closed and closed-loop fluid administration will help improve compliance and take some of the decision-making away from clinician and help them in, during the process. And in fact, we recently completed a multi-center prospective observational evaluation of one such semi-closed loop system. And looking forward to share the results with the rest of the community in the near future.
Well, we look forward to that. Dr. Fisher, you write in the manuscript that the adoption of goal-directed therapy has been slow to come about in clinical practices. What is your opinion on why this is?
There is evidence for the benefit of perioperative goal-directed therapy, but its adoption is effectively slow at the bedside. Nearly 10 or 20% of high-risk surgical patients. One explanation for the poor use of hemodynamic monitoring could be the invasiveness and time to use these devices. So non-invasive and plug-and-play methods could be very interesting, but they need some robust validation for their accuracy before commanding their use in clinical routine.
So, Dr. Maheshwari, notwithstanding your soon-to-be-published study, do you think we need more studies on goal-directed therapy, or do you think we can put this issue to rest?
Well, it's going to take a long time before we put this issue to rest. Goal-directed therapy is a complex therapy based on different technology in different clinical settings where it is implemented, and different outcomes which are assessed. I'm sorry to say that, but the issue is alive, and what we need is high-quality randomized control trials with different technologies in different settings, and which show either goal-directed therapy improves outcomes, which are clinically meaningful outcomes, or not. And if it does show that it improves outcomes, then we should use it for all relevant patients. And if it does not improve outcomes, then we should stop wasteful spending and focus on other high-value areas.
Well said. I guess, you know, it's a multi-layered sort of question to answer, though, right? We've talked about these different devices. I mean, there's even differences of opinion about how much fluid should be given based on the measured variables. And, you know, the use of vasopressors or vasoactive agents versus fluid. And then the variety of surgeries and the difference between low-risk and high-risk patients. And then the vast difference in outcomes that are measured. You know, is length of stay, I guess, the best measurement versus acute kidney injury versus, major adverse cardiovascular events. So I guess lots of great opportunities as many things go. I hope you stimulated folks' interest in this, and perhaps we don't have all the answers from this study or this discussion, but have raised a lot of interesting points and questions for the future. I do hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read these important articles to learn more. Thank you very much, Drs. Fisher and Maheshwari, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.